Hello, and welcome back to another week of Stoner. This week on the show, I think this is my first filmmaker guest. I love talking to people about movies as I love watching movies. I had on Sebastian Silva. He's a director I've really liked. I think his best known movie in America is Crystal Fairy. He's had several, he's from Chile, but he's had several features come out in English. He's a really fascinating person. I didn't really know that much about him. And my friend Jen was working on editing one of his films, and I asked if she would let me ask him if he wanted to come on. He showed up, and within the first 1 minute we started taping, he had taken off his shirt, and that was when I knew this would be a good interview. So here he is, Sebastian Silva. Tell me about your show.
I wanted my show to be like about like couple therapy and like giving people advice for romantic stuff. It was like kind of like a tarot reader without cards.
Do you think you give good romantic advice?
Yeah, I think I'll be really good. I'll make the right questions. I'm really good at bringing information out of people, you know?
Yeah. What, like, couples that are in trouble or just, like, any couple?
No, like, for instance, single people that want to find somebody.
Find love.
Like, yeah, and then they are being unsuccessful. Maybe I can, like, give them guidelines to to find better ways to, yeah, like, find true love and also sex advice.
Yes.
How to spice things up or how to bring them down, how to cool them off. Just anything, man. It's like a therapist, actually.
Do you draw a lot on, like, stories from friends, people's relationships, that kind of stuff in your work?
Yeah, very much. I mean, like, not, I haven't done much, like, relationship stuff. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, I haven't done any, like, I haven't done any, like, love story yet. Not really. Not at all, actually. But, yeah, I steal from everything. Like, all my movies are kind of biographical in a sense. But yeah, like, love stories, yeah. I would love to make a movie about a relationship, a love relationship, but it has to be the right one, you know?
So you're in the middle of a movie right now. Like,
yeah.
Editing,
yeah.
What's your life like when you're like in the thick of a project?
Well, right now I don't know if the editing is the thick of a project. I guess it is, but I would say that production is truly the thick of a project. So when that's happening, I'm just taking Adderall and going to bed. Like morning, half Adderall, coffee, direct, eat, go to bed. And then repeat until the shoot. I don't take Adderall for all my shoots, but the last one I did. But yeah, right now, with editing, I found an editor that I really trust, and she's edited three of my movies so far. So it's a relief, you know. I don't need to be over her shoulder telling her where to put every single frame. So I rented a studio in Dumbo, and I'm painting while she's editing, and then I'm there, you know. I'm there all the time. So, that's what's going on right now, painting and editing.
Is your life, like, sort of move in cycles of these, like, creative pursuits? You go through, like, a movie cycle, and then at some point you're in, like, an art cycle?
No, painting has always been a thing, even more steady than film, but since my career became to, because, like, to sell paintings, it's like, you gotta be very lucky that you fall into the right place, you know, and then you start living out of that. Eventually, I hope that'll happen, but for now, kind of film took over, and the cycles, I'm always writing. Like, now I just finished a new screenplay, and I'm not writing anything, which feels strange, because I'm always, like, writing, so I'm like, now maybe that love story.
You grew up in Chile.
Yeah.
What's the kind of outlook when you're like, hey, I want to become a filmmaker in Chile?
Right.
Smaller population.
Yeah, I hear you. Like, I feel that now everybody can kind of say that with a lot of confidence, just because it feels so easy to get a camera and shoot something presentable, you know? And it's all about the writing. There's movies that really don't have any sort of production value, quote unquote, but they work great and the performances are great and they just really nailed it with the subject matter and like the maturity or the point of view. And then those tiny movies make it to big festivals or win an award or get critically acclaimed, and that's how you start building up. But in Chile, when I decided to be one, it was really an accident. I was not really planning to make movies. I started writing screenplay because I wanted to learn how to tell stories, which felt very difficult. So I started writing screenplay, and then the third or fourth screenplay that I've written, I was encouraged to go and take it around and see if I could make it into a movie. But I was really not planning on doing that. And I lucked out that this Chilean filmmaker, Pablo Larraín, you've heard of him. He made this movie, Jackie. So he has a production company in Chile, and I was doing illustrations for his brother, some other gigs. And then, I went to him and I'm like, hey, I know you have a production. I wrote this movie. I'm sorry. And then they
read it.
I apologize. I wrote this. I don't know anything about it. But see if you like it. And they liked it and they produced it. So I really lucked out. You hear very few cases of people that don't even have to show up their screenplay around. Like, I really didn't. The first person I show it decided to produce the movie. It was a cheap movie, but still, it's money I don't have, you know, to make a movie.
Is it strange? I mean, you make very specific movies with like dark tone that are often like not totally like audience crowd pleaser. Is the equation of doing that kind of work different in somewhere like Chile that's making less movies per year? Like, how many movies a year when you were growing up were being produced in Chile? Like, when you were going seeing?
Yeah, I have no clue. I think very little. Way less than now. You know, yeah. I guess so many more movies are being made now. Like, you know, everybody can make a movie. Like, truly, like, with an iPhone, you can shoot a movie and it would look way better than The Maid or movies that I made with, like, the new fucking cameras then.
The entire equation's changed.
Yeah.
As someone who makes movies that like don't have a huge budget, there's still like a huge amount of logistics that go into doing what you do.
It really depends on when you're making. Like, for instance, this movie that I just shot now, it was a movie that occurred to me. The idea occurred to me in January 9th, and then the movie was being shot in February, like late February. So that was a movie that, it required actors, you know, but then I call all my best actor friends and then random friends that are not actors that would play secondary characters. It's my friend's house in the Catskills. I wrote a screenplay in 10 days, like really not getting precious about it and like knowing that, it won't be a perfect movie, but then not every movie has to be perfect. And I feel that there are projects that can be that small.
Yeah.
You know, like you're like, let's do it for 10 days. And then if the movie doesn't come out great, it wasn't supposed to. Like, not every movie needs to be a masterpiece, you know?
Did you just come out sort of comfortable with the idea of not everything has to, like, take on and be giant like that? Or is that something you learned over time?
I learned it over time, but it was quickly that I felt very suspicious about the idea of growing bigger. Like, I'm not going to say it's an American thing, but it does feel
You can
that,
say it's an American thing.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if it's just American, but it feels that... I've been here.
Yeah.
Really, this is where I live. And it feels that here, when I made The Maid, you know, and The Maid won Sundance, whatever, international competition. And then the stakes that I felt that people had for my next projects were bigger than The Maid, which was fucking tiny. It was like a $300,000 movie, you know. But I don't really function like that. I don't feel that when you make a successful movie, your next movie needs to be bigger in terms of budget or in terms of cast. It's a tricky thing, and I think, I don't know, I haven't really counted the cases, but I wouldn't be surprised that it's somehow ruined or delay a lot of people's career.
Well, there's definitely a trajectory among American filmmakers where if you make a really, really, really successful independent movie, you can get like a comic book movie, and then you've done that. Then that's the next few years of your life is either succeeding or failing in the comic book movie.
Yeah, for me, I don't know, man. Like, it really depends on the career you want to have and like what's your approach to filmmaking. Because for me, it's really about storytelling, you know. I collaborate with really good, awesome DPs, you know, but I'm not like a film geek. Like, I'm not really like looking at gadgets or cameras and the internet, or like, I'm not even a cinephile. Like, I don't feel so jealous of people that get in festivals or big festivals in general. Like, I feel very relaxed with the craft of filmmaking, and it feels that I treat it very much like I treat painting or even writing poetry, which is a very like intimate process. But even though the filmmaking process requires a crew and requires more of a collective effort, it still feels very personal. So I really, I've never really read anybody's material other than mine. Like, I don't ask my agents to, hey, what's the big movie out there? Like, get me a fucking superhero movie. I would die before I make a superhero movie.
You seem, if you're not a connoisseur of like gadgets, it seems like you're a collector of sort of human experiences and like types of uncomfortable experiences. When I think of your films, the only thing I can really compare them to, like in American stuff that I'm really into, is like Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Right.
And sort of exploring some of the most uncomfortable situations that people can find themselves
right,
in.
Right.
Where does that come from for you? And like, how do you take notes when you see people interacting on the street and stuff like that?
Not so much. I think like, stuff like that, I think, is just stuff that I've learned. Like, I'm very, very observant with people, and I guess I make fun of a lot of. I make fun of people. Like, I love people making fun of myself too, and I judge people a lot too, and I don't mind that people judge me.
Yeah.
Like, I like that judgments and mockery and sort of like an affectionate sort of trolling are part of my relationships with people in general, and. I find that violence, quote unquote, is like a kind of an invitation to intimacy. But I really thrive on human struggle. I think I feel that my work, even though it has that and it is comedic at times, it kind of aims for a little bit more of a compassion and sort of acceptance of people. Like, what I do in my movies is that I make my audience judge negatively my characters in the beginning, and then I display some kind of humanity out of these characters that make the audience understand where they were coming from, and their hatred and judgment on them is turned into compassion and sympathy.
When you hear that, okay, so you made a movie called Nasty Baby, which was your most recently released film.
Yeah.
And I know that like when it premiered, like it's got a dark turn to it. And I know that some people
spoil it. Walked
out. Well,
if you need to.
I think just saying it, like it has a tonal shift and a dark turn.
Yeah.
And I know that some people like loved it. I've talked to people who loved it. And I also have heard that like at early screenings, some people walked out.
Right.
So when you're trying to make that empathetic turn and then you're like, you see someone heading for the door, you like, oh shit, they didn't experience empathy for this character.
Right.
Or like, how do you deal with audience expectation and that kind of
thing? I guess in that movie, man, it's like the opposite actually.
Oh,
right?
Really?
Because like the tendency of watching those characters is to sympathize in the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
And then once they fucking... Yeah,
murder a homeless man
that is like mentally disabled. You cannot help but judge them. But that movie is tricky because it's hard to also condemn those characters because it seems that everything was sort of part of an accident, and it's forcefully made and written and directed that way, where it's ambiguous. That movie specifically, and then this movie I made right now, it's called Tyrell. I'm playing with something a little even more so than the other movies, where there's no moral outcome. Like, there's no fable. There's nothing to learn or to unlearn. And I'm just exposing things and people that are very contradictory. Nobody seems to be the evil guy or the good guys. And so the movie just invites you into an experience without telling you at all how to feel morally about the ethics of the movie or the ethics of the characters, you know?
When I went to see Crystal Fairy, it was billed as kind of a drug movie. There's like a sort of a subset. This show is called Stoner and sort of concerned with like changing weed legality in America Stoner culture and all that kind of stuff. And it's not exactly the movie it was marketed by the American distributor as, I feel like. I don't think it was poorly marketed. It actually made me want to see it, so it obviously succeeded. But how do you see that perception of the movie?
Yeah, I'm going to generalize Americans again.
Go wrong.
But yeah, I feel that there is like a tendency to like stereotype things so quickly here that it's like if you make a movie that has like a drug in it, then it's a drug movie. Like, I don't know. It's a movie about self-discovery and compassion, the early signs of compassion, way more than it is about the mescaline to me.
What was your relationship with like drugs when you were younger growing up?
It's always been very friendly, very welcoming, extremely welcoming.
People smoke a lot of weed in your movies, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, it's so
casually.
Part of my life. Yeah, it's like it's been part of my life since I'm 16 and like Can you be an addict, a marijuana addict? I don't know if there is even a definition for that.
You can. I think if you smoke weed for a really long time, you're probably addicted to it.
Okay, so I am. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but no more than you can be. I'm also addicted to coffee, I would say.
Right. Yeah. Me too. Yeah. But.
What's the culture like in Chile? Like what?
Yeah, marijuana. Like? It's always been there. Like now nothing. It's like New York or LA, I guess, yeah. or other places here that it's like. You know, you can really get whatever you want, you know? Yeah, in Chile, it's way more limited, but it's so common to get a joint. If you, anywhere you go, you're like, hey, anybody has, and somebody will have, you know? It's not as easy access as here, I guess, you know? There's less demand and less offer, but yeah, it's pretty chill. But yeah, my relationship with drugs is, as I told you, has been very welcoming. I'm willing to try anything once. You know, and other things a little more.
Do you smoke weed when you're writing, or are you?
Yeah, I have. I have to tell you, I mean, like, smoking weed every day or more than once a day, it fucks up with your memory. Like, yeah. it makes you very stupid. Stupid, like, dumb. Like you're in a conversation and you lose track of the conversation.
Yeah.
Or you started a conversation and then they ask you and you don't know what you were talking about.
It's very obvious if you record yourself a lot when that's happening.
Exactly, right? So, like...
How do you deal with that?
You have to just be very apologetic and like just be very self-loathing when it comes. Like when you forget people, you're like, I'm sorry. It's like I smoke a lot of marijuana. And like it's not just a silly excuse. It is true. I truly believe that when I'm sort of like, when I'm smoking every day, a couple of times a day, I'm way slower and dumber and I leave my keys. I lose my debit card constantly. Like... I think for the last 3 months, I've lost it, I don't know, 5 times. And it's like, I have to blame marijuana.
Do you pull back when you're like making a movie or something like that?
You know what? No. Like, I guess the first day is better not to for me because the team is kind of getting adjusted to each other. Like, you need to understand the dynamic with your DPs. You've never worked with them or like your AD, like the actors. Like, you cannot be stoned from the start off, I think, for me at least. But once you're comfortable, it's fun, you know, because, I mean, for me, even though I've been smoking for 20 years right now, like, still gives me a different perspective.
When and how do you find the ideas that have been the most important to you in art and filmmaking?
I think, like, some things inspire me, some things concern me, you know? Some things worry me, some things scared me. So it depends where I'm going, like... When I did a thriller and now I just wrote another sort of political horror movie, those come from fears, you know, and usually are fears of losing your mental capacities, abilities, not memory. I don't give a fuck about my memory. It's everything. It's on the internet. I don't care. So you see, now I'm blanking. That's the marijuana.
Where good ideas
come
from?
Oh, right, yeah. No, like, because, like, ideas come from different places. They come from your fears or from inspirations or from things that make you laugh or from things that you long for.
Yeah.
You know? I guess all of the above. Like, for instance, the latest movie I shot, it's about the alienation that I perceive in black people among white people. Kind of like people that I see regularly, you know? Like... sort of privileged people in the art world or not in the art world, but close enough, you know, like, and I've seen it in New York. I mean, all of the places that I've been in New York, LA, and then a lot of time I've seen a handful of white people and just one black person. Like there's a lot of like, three black people and then everybody else is white. And then I'm not white, I'm Latino, you know, but I pass as white, I guess, you know, when I don't open my mouth, you know, and like, for me, it's hard not to put myself in their shoes and how it would feel, you know? And there's very rare occasions that I've been the only light-skinned person among only black people, and you really are so self-conscious personally in those experiences, you know? So you wonder how black people feel among white people, especially white American people, you know, and all the history, you know? So that is something that feels it comes from a place of curiosity, I guess, and empathy, and also kind of political concerns, political and social concerns, you know, and that was my latest movie, you know, so that's where the idea came from.
You seem kind of fascinated by like race in America, and I can totally feel you.
Yeah,
like it's a place for you that I hadn't really perceived, which is, I know that you've said, like, I read an interview with you where you said, like, yeah, I don't really want to be identified as, like, a, like,
Latino gay,
filmmaker,
yeah.
a gay filmmaker. Yeah, yeah, and it's yeah. like, I totally understand
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
But there aren't that many people who could say, I'm going to make a movie about race in America and not either be a white, like a white person making yeah. a, which is a very loaded thing, or be a black person, which means you're a black filmmaker making a black, you know, right. a black film or a yeah. film about race. You're in this kind of like distance placed because you're neither of those things. You're like
right.
a Latino, you know, you're not an American person
yeah, yeah, yeah.
at all. But you have these actors who are white and black Americans yeah. appearing in your movies, and they're like, they're actually speak, you know, making up dialogue and sort of speaking as their characters. Like, how do you make your actors comfortable in situations like that?
In this particular case, which is my first real exploration, like, directly on race in America, because Nasty Baby has it too.
Yeah.
But then with this movie, yeah. again, I am somehow portraying this scenario, right?
Yeah.
Where there is one black dude that doesn't know these white guys. They're not evil, these white, they're just like young, just like him. They have their dynamics, they like certain kind of music, they like certain kind of jokes, you know?
Yeah.
And then he's just not part of the dynamic. So it's a movie, I know I'm playing with fire, but since I'm not taking a side so clearly, it's hard to pinpoint what am I doing wrong or right, because I'm trying not to do either.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to show you a total possible situation that could happen in America in a house upstate with like middle class people in their 20s or their 30s. Like, this could have happened for sure in existence. I'm showing it to you, and then I'm sorry if you feel offended or you feel that it should have been different, you know?
It seems like you're like very acutely aware of like the vibe in your movies. Like in Crystal Fairy, like all the characters kind of like talking about whether it's going to be like a good vibe and the vibes amongst the characters. For you, as someone who has smoked a lot of weed mm-hmm. in your time, and I assume been in social situations like that, like how does that kind of like a feeling of the vibe interact with like an improvisational experience like amongst actors? How do you create an environment, I guess, where people are like comfortable expressing themselves?
Well,
you took off your shirt when you first came in here, which did
so that's
which,
what I do.
It made me feel at ease, and it made me think that you probably
I'm sweaty as my back is like pouring right now. I sweat very like,
well, and there's that idea in Nasty Baby too of the performance art piece that your character wants to do, which is basically like making yourself really humiliated and uncomfortable so
yeah.
other people feel at ease comparatively. Ooh, kind of
right
sort of getting out in front of the discomfort.
Yeah, I guess like I'm pretty direct with people, and whoever I'm going to be collaborating with needs to understand that and hopefully communicate in that layer of yeah. like directness and like openness, you know. Otherwise, there's going to be a clash, you know. And like, it's not that I would ever be mean, but I would probably just not even start a collaboration with somebody that I don't feel that they're very authentic and sort of bullshit free, you know. The actors that I work with in this latest movie, they were all so game, dude. Like, we invited them with no, like, we're like, hey, we're shooting a movie, 10 days, no breaks, 14 hours a day, we pay you like shit, can you come next week? Like, that was the invitation, you know?
Yeah.
And like, everybody that said yes was so game, and like, that was enough to start the best dynamic. Everybody felt so comfortable, you know? And like, also what helps with dynamics like that, especially when you're doing improv, is that we were shooting the entire movie in one house upstate, so we were staying together every day. Nobody went home after the shoot, you know? So
yeah.
it doesn't so feel so much like a job, but more like you're camping with people and doing activities.
That sounds really fun, actually.
Yeah, it is really fun. I've been lucky that two of my movies, Magic and this one, were like that, where you have the actors, you can go talk to an actor at any time. Like
yeah.
you wake up at 4 a.m, you're like, whoa, I need to write it. Or I talk to this guy, record this voice. Like every element is there. And then back to how to make people feel comfortable. I'm very, I guess, very silly on set. Even though I'm very focused, I'm like, I never take my shits too seriously. Like, seriously, I don't, I'm not trying to make masterpieces with movie. I don't care. I think I have a special sort of affection for movies that are clumsy, you
yeah.
know, and that not perfect. I'm not really a big fan of like long shots that are, look fucking beautiful, and it's like 40-minute shot that it never stopped. Like, I don't care so much for the craft of filmmaking, and like, I think I would prefer to have a fun, warm shooting than an amazing movie that wins the Palme d'Or. Like, yeah. I don't care so much for the success of. I want the movie to be good, you know, but and it's not that I'm fooling around on set, like just not doing my job, but I never know exactly what I want. And I guess that makes people feel that they're part of the process and they're not just an element that you hire to achieve your vision. You know what I'm saying? I don't have a vision like that. But you know what? Like, there are projects, like, because also, like, it's been an accident that I'm making these little tiny improv movies. It's really an accident. I'm supposed to be making big movies, but I've written them, you know, but I just can't make them because it takes too much effort. Like, and I've done the effort, but I can only do that much to get a big actor or to get those, all of those $1 million that you need to produce those like visions of yours, you know, like, I guess I don't care so much about my visions to stop everything I'm doing to only achieve that eventually, you know? I prefer to do these little tiny movies that I never saw coming, and then they're even a surprise for myself.
At the end, I like to sort of ask everyone the same set of questions.
Yeah, feel free.
So my first one is, do you remember the first time you ever smoked marijuana?
Yeah, it was so bad because I think the first time I smoked marijuana, this is going to sound so raunchy and crazy, but it had crack, but or it was crack, but it was a Chilean crack. And it was I was very young, and it was a gardener that worked at my friend's house, like outside. Like, it was a gardener, and he offered us weed. He's like, hey, guys, you want to try this? And we tried it, and it was crack. Like, it was not weed. And it was a mix or something. So that was the first time. And I was like, whoa, shit, this is insane. Like, I was riding my bike back home, like, on crack. And then that was the first time. And then I think the second one was the same, like, with the same friend. And even the gardener was there, too. But, yeah, it was kind of clean weed.
After the first time, the gardener asked you again, you're like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, but I think he explained that we came to find out that there was, like, an added element to that joint. but that was the first time. I think I was, like, 16 or something. Yeah. And I think I got hooked, quote, unquote, because, I mean, going back to the addictive part of marijuana, like, I've been to places, I would never travel with weed myself, like some people do, I don't, you know, but there's so many places that I've been where there's no marijuana available, and like, I just forget about it, I'm not thinking about it, so I guess it can be addictive like that, like we were saying, but I've never had a withdrawal of marijuana ever in my life, so I guess it's different.
Do you get weird dreams when you stop for a while?
Well, I mean, I get dreams.
Yeah.
Period.
For someone like you, dreams must be really intense. Like, do you take them really seriously?
I do, man, especially if I'm doing therapy, and like, because they really help to begin therapy conversations. So, yeah, I mean, you know what? I guess the times that I've quit marijuana, it's been because I'm missing my dreams. And it's not that I never dream when I'm smoking weed, but like less, way less for sure. And it's not that you don't dream. I think it's you don't remember them.
Do you know like when you hear stories about like the 1930s, the town would have like one movie screening and they'd come drive and show one movie. And that would be a kid would have only seen like one movie. I feel like that's my relationship to dreams. They're all very profound because I've had so few dreams that I remember. They're like, each one is like one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. When you smoke weed now, what's your favorite way? Are you a joint person?
I'm a big one-hitter kind of guy because it's just so easy. And I kind of always have a one-hitter in my pocket. But I always appreciate a joint. I mean, any form. Like, I was doing wax. And I was doing oils, but then I stopped. I went back to grass.
What drove you back?
I wasn't really sure what I was inhaling, truly. Like, I don't know what they put on those things. Those oils taste very funny. They taste good, but there's definitely something added to it. Like, that cannot only be THC. I don't buy it.
Have you experienced the whole, like, L.A. legalized world?
I did. I had a license because I spend time in L.A. a lot, and I had a license for a while. I went to Dr. Green. Yeah, I promise. He's a person.
What did you cite as your malady?
I said that that when I wake up, my first thought is that I want to kill myself. That's what I said. So I was like, saying that I was very depressed.
You didn't worry that I was going to trigger some kind of other warning
that he was
in the
like,
system?
Like press a button under the table? No, but you know what? I think there is a little bit of truth to that. I think marijuana has been a little bit of an antidepressant for me all my entire life.
Yeah.
And is why I do it too, you know? And it doesn't feel that I'm escaping anything, but yeah.
What's one place that you visited that was really memorable for you?
Cuba. I think Cuba was very memorable because it feels so familiar just because they speak Spanish, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that already makes it feel so, so extremely
were
familiar.
When you were growing up in Chile, would kids visit Cuba as like a tourist destination?
No, not at all. None of my family members, I were seven siblings and my parents are still there and none of them have been to Cuba. So it's not a very popular destination. I went when I was here, actually. I went from Chile, but I was invited to the film festival. And yeah, I mean, because that was very memorable. Just like the contradictions of it all, you know, like people are so free of all the bullshit that we have here, you know. It's here, it feels so competitive and everybody's like hooked to their phones and like everybody feels so ambitious and everybody's comparing themselves with one another and like clothes are expensive and drinks are like, I don't know. It's like consumption is insane. But yeah, what it was most striking was like that it felt so tragic and also so inspiring. Like,
yeah.
It's like, are they freer or more trapped than we are? Like, it kind of, everybody wants to leave, but you want to tell them that there's nothing out there that they're missing, but they are missing freedom, you know?
Yeah.
Like, on a.
They're like so missing the freedom to find that out for themselves.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so it is very, there's feel of contradictions and like you can't help but to feel, yeah, very torn.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the place.
Did you feel like you needed to like leave where you were from to feel freedom?
From Chile?
Yeah.
I guess so. I don't know about like freedom seems too big, you know, but like, yeah, there's too many Chileans in Chile. That's it. It's like, it is really feels like one flavor, you know? And yeah. Like,
I mean, I feel that way about where I'm from. I'm just from somewhere else in America.
Right. Know? It's all just Americans.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would feel that way. And I feel that way even in Paris, that is very cosmopolitan. It still feels too many French, you know? And in LA also, it feels like, wait, too many white Americans. You know, it's New York really feels like the perfect place for me. And like, I'm just very spoiled. I don't know if I will ever find a city quite like this. Because, like, it's really the diversity that keeps me here because sometimes you can't help but to hate these fucking places. So it's stressful and like, it's like the competition, I guess. I don't know. It's hard to like stay away from all of those things, you know, like you're somehow brought into, like I found myself feeling very competitive and it doesn't really have much to do with who I am, and I feel that I'm being brought or drove into something against my will, you know. So it's a city that forces you to keep up with yourself, you know, and keep humble and focus.
Can you recommend one stoned viewing experience, TV,
oh
movie?
My god, yes. Roar. R-O-A-R.
Okay. I'm not familiar with it.
Tell okay, me. Roar, like a lion, right?
Yes.
So Roar, it's a movie, I forgot who, I just watched it, and I yeah. forgot who, I'd never, like,
I've never
didn't
heard
care
of it,
who directed yeah. it, right? But Melanie Griffith is in it as a, it's a family, it's a movie made in the 70s by, I think, Melanie Griffith's stepfather, or it's like a family. It's like Melanie Griffith is there, she's the daughter of the man that yep. it's, the father of this family in it's the whole movie is based in LA, but they make you believe that maybe it's in Africa. It's a mess, but it's basically a movie about big cats like lions and pumas and tigers and leopards, and there's like 150 lions on set at all times chasing this guy's family, and you see the actors terrified to have to be acting in like among lions, like truly big ass lions that are fighting with each other. 70 people were injured in this movie. They say it's called the most dangerous movie ever made. You should buy it because renting it is not enough. Like
you've,
I promise.
You've come back
like,
for multiple times.
I mean, it's like what I show my guest. Like somebody comes to my house, I'm like, sit down, I need to show you something. It's fascinating. Like I don't watch many movies. I'm like, I like to make them, you know, but I don't feel very strongly about sitting in front of a movie myself. I don't, you know, movies seem so similar to life that life always seems to be a better choice. But this is just incredible. I mean, the willpower of this guy and his fascination and his fetish with these lions and big cats, and to drive everybody to make his dream come true. It's like a $12 million movie made in the early 70s, which made no money whatsoever. It's a total flop. And they tried to revive it like 2 years ago. I think they put it in theaters. Nobody gave a shit again about this movie, but it's truly a miracle. Like, it's like, I don't know, high art. It is fascinating. I really recommend that. And then this is a good, I guess, this both really good stoner movies, because the other movie, it's a documentary that The Orchard is distributing. It's called Unacknowledged.
Unacknowledged?
Unacknowledged, yeah. And it's a movie about UFOs. So that one, just like, watch it, man. Because, like, I don't know how you feel about UFOs. It feels like nobody really has a strong opinion about that. Like, everybody's like, yeah, I don't think so. But then, did we make everything up? Like, what is there any evidence, you wonder? Is there any legit evidence? And then, supposedly, this documentary is the one documentary that has legitimate information about UFOs. I mean, as legitimate as it can get, you know? But I think it's a good time to watch that, just because of this, like, post-truth,
yeah,
that people are talking about, and fake news and all of this, like, normalization and all of this bullshit, where it's very hard to know who to believe nowadays, you know? It's so confusing. Like, I really feel adrift. I feel that society is just adrift and, like, lost as fuck. I don't trust anyone. So this documentary comes in at a good moment, because you're like, oh shit, is this another of their lives, you know? So that's fun. I mean, it gives you a little hope, you know? It's hopeful to think that we could be like some kind of Machiavellian experiment. It makes more sense.
It does. I mean, it's comforting.
Like, it's comforting to know that people are playing with us.
That was the biggest revelation to me about, like, everything like that was big when I was a kid, like, you know, Bigfoot, UFOs or whatever, yeah, is that people aren't making them up to scare themselves. They're making them up to comfort themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That,
yeah, absolutely.
It's more comfortable than the world we live in, to live in a world where we're really controlled by alien overlords,
oh, man,
or whatever.
Please. Yeah, it would make so much sense. Yeah, bring it on. So yeah, those two movies, Roar and Unacknowledged.
Do you have a favorite snack?
Yeah, fruit.
Fruit?
Yeah.
All fruits?
Yeah, I mean, like, my favorite fruit is watermelon, and but that one's hard to find, good watermelon. Like, yeah, it's usually shitty.
Sometimes,
but
you get like an all-water watermelon.
Yeah, watermelons, if it's not summer, they suck. And it's also a hard snack. You have to bite it chopped off. So let me think. I like dry fruit, like dry mango. It's a good snack. What fruit I really like, man? Apples. I love apples, yeah.
Good apple.
Yeah, a good apple, yeah. A good red apple, yeah.
Do you have an album that you feel like you can get, like, lost in, that brings, like, your mind to a specific place?
Yeah, man,
place?
There's some albums that I'm so stuck with since I'm 19. Like, for instance, yeah, Brian Eno, Music for Airports.
Yeah.
That one is just so pleasing. Like, yeah, it just, you can play it and everything feels very clean and breezy, and it's like that you have time, like, time, you feel that time is on your side.
I find myself continually more and more attracted to music that, like, with the idea of it looping in the background, or just sort of like serving as a cushion,
yeah,
under my life rather than a focal point.
Yeah, yeah. It really depends. Like, yeah. If I want to dance, it's not going to be Brian Eno. Or if I'm in a car with friends, it's, yeah, probably not going to be Brian Eno either, you know? But Brian Eno, it's a good choice. I mean, Music for Airports, it's a good choice for when you get home tired, or even when you're in an airport, actually.
I heard it once. Have you ever heard it in an airport?
Yes.
I heard it in an airport and I was like, oh my God.
It makes total sense, yeah.
And it came up on me in that very creeping way too,
yeah,
where I was like, I know this, where am I?
No, it's the best, man. So that album, and then Digable Planets, you know, their first,
yeah,
album is something that I just never stopped listening, and it serves also as ambient music to me. Like, those two albums are things that I put, as you're saying, like, you're not focusing on them, it's just background.
Was familiar. Digable Planets big in Chile?
They were known among my tiny little group of people that,
yeah,
love music. Yeah, no, yeah, they were not known.
What's one thing you're looking forward to in the rest of your life?
It would be really nice to fall in love and be loved back. That would be awesome. But that's not something I have so much control of. So for the things that I have control, I think I would like to inspire and even, like, nowadays, mobilize people politically, maybe, yeah, through the stuff that I'm doing. Like, I was very focused on personal stories, as you well known. Like, I guess Nasty Baby started getting a little more pressing on not political issues, but I feel that Nasty Baby is so much about white guilt, or not white guilt, but privilege.
Yeah,
like privilege guilt, and like that's big, being privileged. You know, I guess I can be extremely self-loathing and call out other privileged people on their privilegism, if that's a word. But I guess inspiring people and becoming a better professional and a better person in general. You know, like, I'm 38 and I there's a lot of things that I would like to find peace with as I grow older. So I guess finding peace, you know, and projecting that.
We started this conversation with you saying that you would like to do a show that therapy. Did this feel like did this feel therapeutic?
So far, yeah, man. Yeah. You're right. We've been talking about nice stuff. It feels very personal, but we will get way deeper into my show. If I had a show, it would get very deep.
This would be like the introduction. Then you'd be like, now let's really talk.
Yeah. Okay. That show, the therapy show.
Yeah, they'd
we'll
be crying.
Talk about it. They'll be crying or very excited, or they'll go out and try all of the advice that I gave them, and then we'll see how it went.
Okay, more on that soon. Thank you very much for coming
you,
on the
man.
Show.
Thank you, man. Yeah, thanks so much.
The basement studio in which I record this show flooded, so I'm just yelling into my computer right now. This show was edited by Courtney Harrell. Thanks, Courtney Harrell. She's one of our new editors. You can get in touch, hi@stoner.co, hi@stoner.co. We have a new episode up every Tuesday.